I'm Shalina Tobin, aka Poshnosh Girl. Today I'm joined by the fabulous chef Mark Greenaway. Mark was the only chef in Scotland to be awarded 3 AA Rosettes for culinary excellence in 2012 and will now delight Londoners with a brand new fine dining restaurant right here in the capital. Welcome, Mark. How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, I'm sort of in a broom cupboard in the middle of London at the moment, but apart from that, yeah, I'm really good. Yeah,
amazing. So you have been in London for the last, well, you've been in and out really, haven't you? But you're working on your new fine dining concept and you've opened a pie and mash shop as well.
Yeah, so I've been coming to London probably for like the last 2 years, just doing consultancy on numerous projects, and then we decided sort of about just over a year ago that I would actually have a base in London and we would open a signature restaurant. Then obviously due to the pandemic, building work being really slowed down, it sort of just dragged on and dragged on. So right. hopefully we're looking at an August opening.
Okay.
Yeah, it should be August, maybe September, August, let's say August. Okay. So yeah, I'm super excited and it should be really good.
Well, amazing. And we're looking forward to it. We'll talk a little bit more about the restaurant later on. We wanted to start right from the beginning. So if you could talk us through your beginnings, how you got into the industry. It was a little bit unusual. Tell us all about it.
I mean, I think so right from the beginning. So my birthday falls in December. So when I was 15, I had said to my guidance counsellor at school, you know, when can I leave school? You know, what can I do? Because I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And, you know, you've got to remember back 25, 26 years ago, there was no, you know, being a chef wasn't portrayed as it is now. I had never actually eaten in a restaurant before I became a chef. I didn't even know you could be a chef. And my guidance counselor said, well, what are your hobbies? What do you like doing? And I said, well, I quite like cooking at home. And she said, you know, why don't you be a chef? And that way you can also leave school in the summer, as long as you continue full-time education. And I thought, perfect. So obviously I went home, said to my parents I was going to be a chef. And I'd had the interview lined up for college. And they said, right, well, if you're left school, then you've got to pay us dig money. You know, you've got to pay rent because it's the big bad world and you've got to learn that, you know, if you're not at school, you've got to pay your way. So I sort of grabbed the Yellow Pages, which is a directory of businesses. I don't know if Yellow Pages are still out there or not.
I think we probably have an online form of it. I don't know, actually. That's a good question. I remember a massive yellow book.
And I then phoned all the local restaurants and hotels. Sorry, somebody just came in.
That's
phoned
all, right.
All the local restaurants and hotels to see if I could get a job. And the first place that actually said yes was a place called the Cartland Bridge Hotel, who said, yeah, you know, we've got a job as a KP. You start Monday. So I then obviously ran through to the living room, extremely excited that I'd got a job as what I thought meant, you know, apprentice chef, or I didn't really know what KP meant. I had no idea what KP meant. My parents obviously had no idea what KP meant. So we went out that weekend, bought myself a nice set of whites, a neckerchief, a tall white hat. And on my first day of the kitchen, I turned up probably about an hour early. And the chef, Alistair, said to me, right, your first job is the breakfast pots and pans that the breakfast chef's created over the last few hours. So I'm in this huge sort of pot sink doing all the pots. Straight after that, he said, right, go through to the scullery, do all the crockery and the teapots. And so I'd done that, then came back through. And this lasted all day for about 12 hours. So at the end of the day, I said to Alistair, the chef, I said, chef, I've not cooked anything. And he said, well, yeah, you're a KP. And I said, what does that mean? And he said, kitchen porter. He said, you're here to wash dishes. And I was like, no. No, I want to be a chef. I want to do what yous are all doing. I want to cook. And that's, you know, that's what I want to do. And, you know, back then there was no Gordon, Jamie, Heston. You know, the fact that these people are internationally known by their first name, you know, just shows you how much the industry's changed over the last 25 years. So I just wanted to cook. I just wanted to be a chef because I like cooking at home. I thought it'd be an easy way to make money. I thought it can't be that hard. You know, people come in, sit down, choose off a menu that you've already prepared. Easy money. It's not easy money, not even in the slightest. So he said, come back tomorrow and you can start your apprenticeship as a chef. So that's what happened. So I was quite lucky. Although, you know, every time the breakfast chef phoned in because she was too drunk to come in, or the KP, you know, didn't turn up, I was either on breakfast or back on the dishes. And that sort of lasted about 6 months before. So I was an apprentice chef, but right. I was the first person to get thrown in the sink or put on breakfast. But it was good because it taught me that every job in the kitchen is important. Absolutely. Whether it's the breakfast chef or washing dishes. So yeah. That was sort of my first day as a chef.
And it kind of got your foot in the door as well, didn't it? I mean, that was, you know, your route in was a KP, even though, fair enough, you didn't really know what it was, but you got your foot in the door, and then it was easy for you to progress from there, wasn't it?
I mean, nothing's ever easy, but yeah, because I did turn up, I did do 12 hours in the sink. Yeah. They obviously thought, I mean, I was 15, but they obviously thought, well, the guy can work hard. And that's why they took the risk to actually take on a 15-year-old. You know, when I think back now, I was so young. I mean, the thought of me taking on a 15-year-old now would just fill me with dread. Like, how do you a 15-year-old in a kitchen? But it was different times, you know, so it was, and it got me in the door. And I've never done anything else.
Yeah. What kind of age do you get people coming into your kitchens? What is the average age?
Between 20 and sort of 30 is the average. Right. I mean, the youngest chef we've had is 16.
Right.
But it's such a hard industry.
Yeah.
And it is probably over-glamorized to an extent. You know, it's not all about jumping on yachts and sailing around the ocean and cooking live langoustines as they come out of the water. Mm-hmm. You know, there's another 25 years before that nobody ever sees.
So it's
it is overly glamorized slightly. It's hard work, but...
Well, we all know that, I mean, kitchens are notoriously very, very difficult environments to work in. Has it ever come to blows in the kitchen for you?
No, I mean, it's never gotten physical. I mean, that's something that I've never experienced, nor would I ever stand for it in any kitchen that I'm working in or running. I mean, it's never been to that extent. I think that was probably the generation before me. So right. I think it's probably getting... I mean, it's definitely getting better.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, you know, the generation before me was probably where that was, you know, more relevant than now.
Right, right. So talk to us what happened from then on. You moved to Australia, I know, when you were just age 23. How did that come about and what attracted you to Australia in the first place?
So I had left the Carlton Bridge Hotel to go and work and the Glasgow Hilton. So at the time, it was the only five-star hotel in Glasgow. And I very quickly realised that working in bigger organisations really didn't suit me. So I was 17 at the time. And I thought, I really am just a number here. I'm just, you know, my payslip has a number on it. My opinion's not really listened to. The hours were still horrendous. I was still going in at 6-7 o'clock every morning, working till, you know, 11, 12 at night, sometimes 1 in the morning. And you know, when you're 17, I wasn't really getting listened to, but then why would I? I was only 17. So I thought, I really want to start working back in sort of smaller organizations, smaller brigades. And I seen a job just outside Auchterarder House, called Duckley House Hotel, which was a brigade of five. And I thought, fantastic, I'll do it. And while I was working there, we had a lot of summer workers from Australia. And then I left there, went to Auchterarder House, and again, a very, very small team. And again, during the summer, and this was 1998, there was just a lot of Australians working and saying, oh, you've got to go to Australia. It's amazing weather. It's bigger wages. You know, the food scene's incredible. And I thought, why not? So I packed up, went to Australia for what was going to be a year's working holiday. Stayed 5 years, worked in some incredible places. I mean, the food back in 1999 in Australia was probably, from Scotland, probably 10 years ahead. Right. It was probably comparable or slightly ahead of London at the time, because what had happened a few years before that is a lot of the London chefs who had worked for the huge names at the time, so, you know, Pierre Kaufman, Nicola Dinas, Marco Pierre White, they had all gone to Australia for a better work-life balance. They were now all head chefs, but with this incredible pedigree behind them, that the chefs in Australia really didn't have at the time, because the food scene at the time, when they all got there, wasn't that far in advance. And the food scene in Scotland was so far behind that it was just such an incredible experience, because I was working for all these chefs with amazing pedigree doing food that I had never, ever seen before. I mean, before I left, I remember seeing Marco Pierre White's White Heat at Ducklegs Hotel. And I was reading White Heat and I was thinking, there's just absolutely no way a kitchen can produce food like this in the middle of service. Like, how is that possible? Because I was only comparing it to what I was doing. And at the time we were doing, you know, on a busy Saturday, we had two restaurants, you know, we'd probably be doing 150 covers a service, not thinking, well, he's only doing 40 covers and he's probably got five times the chefs we've got. I was just looking at it from my perspective, thinking, but there's no way he can do this. And the first job I got in Sydney was for a chef called Matt Brown, who had just spent 10 years with Marco Pierre White. So we pretty much replicated White Heat on the menu. You know, not my choice, it was his menu. With a few tweaks and his own little slant on things. But, you know, it was all the pig's trotters and it was all, you know, the assiette of chocolate. And it was pretty much White Heat in a restaurant in Sydney. If I could say that. And so for me, it was the dream job. I then went on to work at some incredibly, you know, amazing places. I then got sponsored so I could stay, which was great. And I ended up spending 5 years there just working incredibly hard. But at the same time, you know, when I got there, I was 23. It was 1999. I was there for the millennium, which has ruined every new year for me ever since. Because it was such an amazing experience to be there for the millennium.
That nothing would match it.
At the Opera House. Now I look at fireworks and go, yeah. just because it was so amazing. And I was there for the Olympics. Yeah. And again, it was just such an amazing experience, because a lot of the streets got made into live sites, which meant there was bars everywhere, huge screens. So yes, I was working incredibly hard. But on my downtime, I was also having an amazing experience, you know, socializing with people that I never thought was possible as a 15-year-old chef washing dishes, you know, just a few years before. So it
was. Well, you were a pretty daring 15-year-old, because you went to Australia just with your chef knives and your whites, with no job, no home, and you just kind of, you just braved it. That was a pretty smart thing to do at that time, wasn't it?
Yes. I mean, I was 23. I mean, before I went, I did try and phone a lot of jobs.
Yeah.
And most, well, all of them were saying, let us know when you're here.
Right.
Because the internet obviously wasn't what it is now. You couldn't just look up a chef, follow them on Twitter, send them a message. It didn't exist. So I literally got to Australia with a rucksack, £2,000 in my bank, which was $5,000 at the time, which to me was a huge amount of money because it was so cheap to live in Australia at the time. Mm. I mean, I think a schooner of beer at the time was $2.50, so it was a pound.
Wow.
probably four times that now.
Yeah, because Sydney, one of the days.
Sydney was such a cheap place to live. So yeah, I looked at the notice board in the airport, got the bus to the local hostel, stayed there for a couple of days, picked up the Sydney Morning Herald, like I did with Yellow Pages, you know, 8 years before, and just went through all the job applicants, the job adverts, didn't really find anything I wanted. So I picked up a copy of the Good Food Guide and phoned all the Three Hat restaurants and said, can I have a job? And Liam Tomlin from the restaurant Bank said, come and see me. So they were opening a sister restaurant down the hill called GPO, and said, come and see me. You can have a job there and we can sponsor you. So it was great. It was, you know, there's nothing wrong with doing things sort of the old fashioned way, yeah. You know, getting the guidebooks out and phoning up the restaurants that you want to work in. And that's exactly what I did. So it was great fun, but hard work.
Yeah, very tenacious. I really I quite respect that the fact that you just went out there and just did it. And Daryl Felsted, he was big inspiration for you as well.
Yeah, so Daryl was the exec chef at GPO in Martin Place. And GPO in Martin Place was just a monster of a building. It had a cheese room with over 2,000 different cheeses, a charcuterie room, a chocolatier, a sushi bar, two restaurants, four espresso bars with juice bars and fresh fruits and desserts. And Daryl was the exec chef. He was, I think he was 26, was 27 at the time. So he wasn't really that much older than me, but he had worked at the Square in London. He had worked for Nicola Dinas, Pierre Kaufman. He had worked with some real heavyweights in London. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was a real taskmaster, but if you want to work for these people, then, and learn their food, it gets done their way. Yeah. And, you know, when you're the boss and you're the head chef, you can do it your way. So I just sort of shut up and got on with it and, you know, learned a huge amount from him at GPO for 2 years or however long I was there. 2 years. And yeah, so he was a great inspiration. Liam Tomlin from Bank again, you know, we used to see him on a daily basis because it was a sister restaurant to Bank, and Liam used to park underneath. And that's people like Justin North, Brett Graham from the Ledbury. You know, they're all products of Liam Tomlin, who's now in South Africa, doing amazingly well over there. But again, a taskmaster. But if you want to work for these people, it's sort of what you do. Yeah. But the real sort of shock for me is when I came back from Australia after 5 years. I then went out, bought the Michelin Guide, bought the AA Guide, started looking at restaurants, started phoning them up, you know, then explaining to people where I'd worked in Australia and Sydney, for them just to say where, never heard of them. Because again, it's not like it is now. You know, when I came back in 2005, I get the internet was nothing like, you know, what it is now. So it's not that I wasted 5 years working there, because I didn't, I learned a huge amount. But obviously when I came back, nobody had heard of.
So no one really recognised the skills no. that come back with.
Yeah, because they've just never heard of these places. I mean, yeah. They've heard of them now, yeah. But we're now nearly 20 years later. So yeah, it was a real sort of eye-opener coming back, especially to Scotland. Yeah. So I spent 6 months travelling around Scotland deliberately doing agency work. And that was because when I came back, you know, I was away from 23 to 28. And as a chef, that's a time where you learn a huge amount as a chef, because I think that's when you realize whether you want to stick to it or you want to get out and do something else, or you mature a lot as a chef and you find out whether you can actually do the job or not. And it's such a valuable time for a chef at that age. And that's when you learn that much. So when I came back, I obviously didn't know where to buy a carrot from, never mind where to get, you know, great staff. So I deliberately toured Scotland for 6 months, just doing agency work, just working for 3 days a week, 2 weeks a month, just to sort of try and find those suppliers, find the staff, see what was really going on. And I worked from everywhere, from, you know, a coaching inn right up to, you know, one of the best hotels in Scotland. So I really tried to get that broad knowledge of what was going on. And ashamedly, it almost looked as if nothing had really changed. You know, chefs were still stuffing chicken with haggis. By then, the dreaded deep fried Mars bar had been invented. And it sort of looked like not a lot had changed within the industry. Yeah. Whereas I had been to the other side of the world, cooking and learning some incredible food. Yeah. So I thought, you know, and I'd been a head chef in Australia before I left. And I thought, well, the only way for me really to get my skills across is to, you know, stop traveling around Scotland and get a job as a head chef, which is what I did. So, and I've never really looked back since then.
So just going back to Australia, I mean, it was obviously really, really good, great learning ground for you. As wonderful as it was, I know that you had quite a traumatic experience where you technically died twice.
Yeah, that.
Are you okay to talk about that? What do you remember at that time?
I mean, it was just a strange accident. I was on a split shift one day, and we were all going out that evening for someone's leaving party. And I've been trying to get out of it for about 2 or 3 days, just because I didn't want to go. And it was on like a Wednesday or a Tuesday or, you know, some random day. So I had said to my chef in the afternoon, I'm going to jump home on the split, get a change of clothes, because I deliberately went to work not wearing the right clothes. So I'd gone to work deliberately wearing shorts, flip-flops, you know, a T-shirt. So I couldn't go out that night. So my sous chef had said to me, well, yeah, I'll see you when you come back. So I had jumped in a taxi, got back to my apartment, jumped out the taxi, went to get into my apartment and realized that I didn't actually have my keys, but one of my neighbors, John, had a spare set of my keys. So I started buzzing him to get him up, because I knew he was on night shift. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon, to no answer. And I thought, maybe he's just sleeping. So somebody had came in before me. So I sort of jumped through the door, went up on the left, chapped John's door, no answer. Went to the fire escape to then get onto my balcony so I could go into my apartment through my balcony, because it's 3 floors up. And as I went to step over onto my balcony, and we're probably talking about half a meter, you know, I wasn't trying to be Spider-Man, I wasn't climbing up the building. My left leg slipped as I grabbed on, which made me cut open my right arm. So that arm then fell to my side. So I was holding on with my left arm. And I thought, I'm never going to be able to pull myself up, so I'm going to have to let myself drop. But there was a balcony below me in concrete. But beyond the concrete, there was grass. So I thought, if I push myself backwards, I'll be able to land on the grass, because I was hanging there. So I tried to push myself backwards, not very successfully. My left leg then hit the balcony below me, which was a concrete balcony, which smashed all the bones in my knee, which threw me backwards. And I not only missed the concrete, but I missed the grass and impaled myself on a metal fence. So luckily there was people in the bottom apartment. So instead of having a balcony, they had this sort of garden area which was paved and then grass and then wall. Luckily they were there watching television. So they obviously phoned the ambulance. The ambulance turned up, the fire brigade turned up. And as soon as they tried to take me off the fence, my lungs collapsed and I stopped breathing. So they had to do an emergency, what's it called when they puncture through your ribs to reinflate your lungs? Not a suture, maybe that. So they had to do an emergency that to then revive me. I then went to hospital. I couldn't get the operation on my knee for a week, because my lungs wouldn't be strong enough. And then as I got the operation for my knee, my lungs then collapsed again, stuck together again. So they had to put another emergency, whatever it's called, through my ribs to then revive me again, because I stopped breathing because my lungs had collapsed and stuck together. So I broke most of my ribs and I had a metal plate put in my knee. And that's sort of how I technically died twice, but was revived. So
wow.
It sort of gives you a whole new look at how delicate life is, but equally how amazing the human body is. I mean, I was in the hospital for 2 weeks, off work technically for 9 weeks, although I was going back to work. But it's just amazing how quickly you can bounce back.
Yeah.
Your body can fix itself.
Yeah. And did it make you more cautious, like more of a cautious person, knowing life is fragile? Or was it like, you know, devil may care to try everything because you never know what's around the corner?
No, it definitely made me a lot more cautious. But also to just work harder as well and think how delicate life can be. Mm. And how quickly, you know, that could have ended very differently.
Yeah.
If, you know, the couple weren't downstairs watching television, they were in the kitchen making their dinner, they would never have seen me. So it just sort of reminds you how delicate life is, and you only get one life, so you might as well make the most of it, I suppose.
And was this sort of incident, was this the catalyst to bringing you back home to the UK?
No, so what happens, there's a strange noise behind me. So I had gotten myself a financial backer in Australia who we wanted to open a restaurant, and that's what we wanted to do. And what had happened in sort of 1999, early 2000, is a lot of people opened restaurants for the Olympics coming, expecting just the city to be overrun with tourists and for everyone to make an incredible amount of money. But what actually happened was, you know, people, the tourists weren't eating in the city centre finer dining restaurants. They were going out to Homebush where the stadium was and, you know, grabbing a burger. And so sort of the 2 or 3 years after that, a lot of the better restaurants started closing. But it was within that period I had found somebody that was having dinner one night that wanted to open a restaurant with me. So we were seriously looking at restaurants and doing site visits and all this sort of thing. When he had then decided, I don't think a fine dining restaurant's the route to go down, because a lot of the city's better fine dining restaurants are closing. But Brisbane's on the way up. So do you want to relocate to Brisbane and we can do it there? And this was, I think, 2004. And I thought, well, if I'm going to move to Brisbane, where I don't know any suppliers, I don't know any staff, I've got zero reputation. And I had a good reputation in Sydney because, you know, I'd gotten into the Good Food Guide and we got great reviews from all the local reviewers at the time. I thought I might as well go home and start again in Scotland. Because I'd been away 5 years, I presumed a lot would have changed. And you just do, you just think everyone's doing the same that you're doing. You don't think you're doing anything different. So that was sort of
the reason you came.
Well, 50% of the reason, the other 50% was the accident. So a bit of both.
Right. So you came back and you worked in various different places. And I think that was actually a really good move just to get your grounding again and to just find out what other restaurants are doing and finding out about suppliers and things like that. So you opened your own restaurant, Mark Greenaway, in 2013. It won numerous accolades. I'd be here all day if I listed them all. But basically, you were the first chef in Scotland to win 3 AA rosettes for culinary excellence. And you're obviously flying high. That restaurant did incredibly well. What made you decide to close it then?
So when we opened 2013, we were the only restaurant that year to be newly awarded 3 rosettes. So other restaurants did have them, and restaurants since have got them. But we were the only new restaurant that year to win them. We had done incredibly well, and we were approached by the Waldorf Astoria to move the restaurant into the Waldorf Astoria. And at the time, we were looking to actually buy the building that we were in, which is North Castle Street, to then do huge renovations, a lot of works, but we just couldn't agree on the sale price, so we ended up not buying it. The building needed a lot of sort of renovation and refurb. We'd been there 5 years. So we thought, well, instead of moving the restaurant, why don't we do something completely different and take up the Waldorf Astoria's offer? And now looking back over the last sort of 18 months, thankfully we did, because there is no way we would have survived the pandemic that the world has just gone through. And obviously to go into the Waldorf Astoria after the Galvins within the Brasserie space, you know, it's 140, 150 cover restaurant. We couldn't be doing the level of fine dining that we were doing at Restaurant Mark Greenaway for those numbers without just having a crazy amount of staff. Mm. So we didn't dumb down the food any. We just sort of changed the style slightly. So, you know, we were still cooking the fish the same way. We were still making the sauces and the purees the same way. We were just presenting it simpler, I suppose. Than what we were doing in our fine dining restaurant.
Right. And Waldorf Astoria speaks for itself, doesn't it? I mean, that is an amazing location.
Yeah, it's not a bad name to have on the CV.
Yeah. And I mean, did you have a full year before the pandemic hit us? How was the restaurant doing?
So we opened in the April and the pandemic happened last March, April. So almost.
You had a year.
Almost. I mean, we opened back up again 2 weeks ago. And it's strange because, you know, the restaurant was doing incredibly well. We had gotten an amazing review from Jay Rayner that I literally couldn't have written better if it was me. Which, again, done great things for the restaurant, because it's, you know, when you get reviewed by someone of that caliber, it sort of puts you in that league.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't open restaurants or write cookbooks to win awards or to get great reviews. You open restaurants and write cookbooks because you feel you've got something to share with people and hopefully they enjoy it. So, and it's weird opening again 2 weeks ago because the restaurant's now 2 years old. It's now not a new restaurant anymore. But to us, it still is, because we were only open a year. But to the rest of Edinburgh, it's been there a couple of years now.
Right, yeah.
Whereas to us, it's still new. It's, you know, not still finding your feet, but still, you know, trying to get it to where it needs to be.
Right. And is that where you are? Where are you right now? Are you in London or are you in Scotland?
So just now I'm in a basement in London.
You're in the basement in London, yeah.
A basement in London. So I'm back in Scotland on Monday.
Okay.
Yes.
So let's talk about, you know, the devastating effect that the pandemic's had on hospitality. There's no denying that it's actually created a lot of opportunity as well. You know, for example, property is a lot more accessible. Landlords are becoming, you know, a lot more easier and more open-minded on maybe commission-based rent. What's your view on it?
I mean, I think for me, selfishly, the pandemic's, I mean, it's been devastating. It's been horrible. But for me, selfishly, it's actually given me time that I've never had. As a chef, I've never had time. And as a chef, any chef, time is something you've never got. And the plan, you know, over a year ago, well, 18 months ago, was to open a restaurant in London. And it was, how are we going to do that? How am I going to have the time to do that? Because you've just never got time. So the pandemic's given me time to say, okay, you know, let's treat my business as a brand. How do we treat that brand? How do we grow the brand? How do we pivot the brand to be something else or to be something new that people either haven't seen or haven't done before, you know? And it's given us time to sort of build a team around me that we can use to our advantage. So we've now got people, branding people, we've now got marketing people, we've now got a CFO, we've now got an ops director. Whereas before, it was myself and my fiance Nicola. That was the company. People, I think, used to think that we were a much bigger company than what we were, but we weren't. We were a tiny little, you know, business operating at North Castle Street. There was, you know, myself and Nicola were the directors. There was nobody else. Whereas the last sort of 18 months has given me time to, you know, get a new business partner, which is fantastic. He's somebody I've known for 15 years. And to grow my brand internally so that we can then grow the brand externally and start doing different, you know, offshoots of the brands or something different, which is how Pie and Mash came along, and my new restaurant that we open in August.
So let's talk about Pie and Mash first. So that's, the idea was born out of the pandemic. Why Pie and Mash?
So, I mean, I'll rewind slightly. So we were meant to open my signature restaurant in London last November. And the idea was open the restaurant, establish myself in London, and then start looking for offshoot brands that are far more casual, far more accessible. So during the pandemic, I came up with probably three or four brands that we could do that with. Three or four different concepts. And one of them was Pie and Mash, because Pie and Mash is so synonymous with London. There's such a heritage there with Pie and Mash, but what no one's tried to do is sort of slightly modernize it, make it slightly more Instagrammable, you know, make pies with these amazing amazing produce. So that was sort of one of the concepts that I came up with to sort of try and modernize the pie and mash. And there's nothing wrong with the classic London pie and mash, you know, the heritage, the history behind it. It should never change. But what I couldn't do is pretend that I have that heritage. You know, I'm not a third generation pie shop like there is in London. So the only way to do it in my mind successfully was to modernize it, to make it my own. So, you know, we do chicken mushroom tarragon, we do duck a l'orange with pui lentils, we do braised beef with pearl onions, we do lamb mint, you know, we do a vegan mince one at the moment, we do an apple pie one with cream and custard. So it was always a plan to do offshoot brands after I had opened my signature restaurant. But because of the pandemic and building work just taking forever, it sort of leapfrogged it before my signature restaurant, which isn't a bad thing, but yeah, it's just sort of leapfrogged it.
And where is the pie and mash shop?
So it's on Villiers Street. So 45 Villiers Street. So just in between Embankment Station and Charing Cross. Mm-hmm. And this Thursday we open another one.
Oh, that's exciting. Yes.
At Newbury Racecourse. So it opens Thursday. It's only open when the race days are on.
Okay.
So it's almost like a part-time pie shop, which is great for us because, you know, our pie shop in Villiers Street's only been open a month. And it means because it's only a part-time pie shop, we can staff it and grow sort of organically into the business, which is great because the plan is to obviously open a few, you know, Greenaway's pie and mash shops around London.
Fabulous.
That just sort of helps us do that. And I've got an amazing manager and she'll look after it. And so, yeah, it's very exciting. Very good.
Yeah, that is exciting. And I think I'll definitely try the one in London. Do you do deliveries as well?
Yeah, so we're on Deliveroo and we're doing a cook at home frozen version.
Okay.
Which should be starting, well, it should have been starting last week, but it should be starting in the next few weeks.
And how is it doing? I'm assuming because you're already opening your second branch, it's doing really, really well.
Yeah, it's doing incredibly well. I think it's one of those things that locals immediately identify with it. They all know what pie and mash is, so you don't have to tell them what it is.
Yeah.
I think because we've sort of modernized it slightly, we're attracting the younger generation as well who want to try duck and orange with lentils or lamb peas and mint. So I think we've covered quite a few of the bases of customer base. And so, yeah, it's doing incredibly well. We're so happy with it. It's good.
Oh, I'm so pleased for you. So let's talk about your fine dining restaurant that was due to open, undoubtedly caused lots of delays by the pandemic.
Yep. But
talk to us about the establishment and you know what it represents.
So we're opening, so we're opening at 3 Henrietta Street in Covent Garden.
Yeah.
On the first floor of the most magnificent building, in my mind, on Henrietta Street in Covent Garden. It's got the most beautiful facade out front. The view is over the piazza. I mean, it's stunning. But it's a 30-cover restaurant, so it's super small. We've got a chef's table with 6 seats and then 26 seats. We've called it Pivot. And the reason that we're calling it Pivot is throughout the whole of the pandemic, all I kept hearing on the BBC or on trade magazines or podcasts was how a business coming out of the pandemic is going to have to pivot, change to the new normal that we're all facing at the moment. And when I looked at the site with my business partner, because it was so small, there isn't the kitchen space to do, you know, an a la carte menu with 6 starters, 6 mains, 6 sweets, plus a tasting menu, plus a slightly simpler lunch menu. So I thought if we just do a really tight 4-course choice, so there's 1 choice for starter, main and dessert, set 6-course tasting menu, and then we change the menu every month. And the only wine that we're going to serve is the wine that goes with the menu.
Wow. Wow.
And that will also change every month. The cocktails will also change every month. And we'll have a spirits cupboard with your gins and your, you know, your vodkas and your rums. But yeah, so the whole menu, the whole wine list and the whole cocktails change every single month. So it's going to be super seasonal, you know, super up to date. And we're going to pivot the menu every month. So it's, you know, something that I've written probably 30 menus for, because every time it was delayed, I would write another menu. So I've just written the first menu that should appear in August when we open. However, if we open in September, I'll throw that menu in the bin. I'll write another one. Just because I want it to be super seasonal. I mean, it's something that as a chef, you have to do, because it's the right thing to do. We should be cooking seasonally. We should be cooking local and all these other things. And it's something that I have been doing for the last 10, 15 years. It's not, you know, although the food will change every month, it's still going to be very much my style of food. Otherwise, it's going to look like I've just changed the head chef every month.
It's not going to be
Thai 1 month and Japanese the next month. And, you know, it's still going to be very much rooted in the style of food that I cook. It's just going to be brand new every single month, which for me is super exciting as a chef, because it means I'll have to keep progressing and pushing myself.
Absolutely.
And training the team. And, you know, as we learn new techniques, either from online or from books, you know, we've got a production, development kitchen upstairs. So each month I will be working on the next menu whilst the last menu is still on. So it's going to push us as a team as well to keep developing and progressing, which I think as a chef is probably the most exciting part of cooking for me, is the development process, is coming up with that new dish.
Yeah.
Standing peeling carrots for 9 hours a day isn't really what excites me now. That's what used to excite me when I was, you know, a commissary chef to party, because you come in, you look at your mise en place list, and you work as hard and fast as you can to get your mise en place list done before service, so you can then do service. Whereas for me now, you know, the most exciting part is developing that new dish and then training the team how to do it, then, you know, doing it during service. And that's where the chef's table with the 6 seats around the kitchen counter is so important, because the customers are going to be right there looking at us, asking questions. You know, the waiting staff aren't going to be serving the customers at that table. It'll be us that serve the customers. The waiting staff can do the wine and the drinks and the water and all that boring stuff. but, you know, so it's going to be super interactive for the 6 seats that are around the chef's bar, chef's table, which I'm super excited about, because it means we're going to have that interaction with guests that I think we've all missed over the last 18 months. So yeah. It's more important now than ever.
Yeah. And I mean, you built up your career based on your love for local produce in Scotland. How does that correlate with your move to London? I mean, what talk to us about the produce and how?
So, I mean, I think I am very passionate about the produce in Scotland. I mean, if we can rewind back to Greenaway's Pie and Mash, the meat that we use in that is from the same butcher that I use in my restaurant in Scotland.
Mm.
It's the meat from the same butcher that I will use at Pivot. So
right.
It's just really important to me to work with these suppliers, to build that relationship, because I think any supplier relationship is a relationship. It is, you know, I can phone up my butcher and say, I'm doing this, can I get that? Can you age it longer? Can you not age it for longer? Can I get it this trim? And he'll do it, because we've built a relationship over the last sort of 7, 8, 9 years. Mm. So I'm going to be using, you know, meat and fish predominantly from Scotland.
Okay.
Fruit and veg, slightly different. We will be buying more local. But then what's local London? You know, there's not many farms in London, as you know. So, you know, we will be looking sort of further afield for things like the fruit and the veg. Berries, we'll definitely be buying Scottish. Raspberries, strawberries, all that sort of thing, just because I think the climate that we've got in Scotland is a little colder, which means things do grow slightly slower, which means they develop more in flavour. I mean, if you go to Wimbledon, when the tennis is on, it's probably Scottish strawberries. It's, you know, we are renowned for them. So I'm going to try and use as much as I can from Scotland, but not to the detriment of the food. You know, if the fish 1 week's coming in better from Cornwall, then I'll buy it from Cornwall. I mean, that's because we'll be working a month in advance for our menus. That's all things that throughout the development process, I'll have time to actually, you know, work on.
Okay, okay. And you did mention briefly about your staff, and are you all your staff from Scotland or are they London?
No, they're all London based.
They're all London based. So they're the new people that you're training up and working with.
Yeah, so I've been, so since last August, I've been based on and off in Covent Garden in James Street. And the whole idea is for the last 6 months, the staff that we've got in James Street that we've been training up and working with, we will move those staff to Henrietta Street for when I open Pivot. So it means that we've got the solid base of the chefs, the waiting staff. So it's not everyone's first day. It's their first day in a new building, but it's not their first day seeing my food. I mean, we're starting, I mean, we're in June at the moment. We're starting food development now for the new menu, which starts in August, unless I have to change it to September. So by the time we open, the staff should already be, you know,
ready,
well-versed. Yeah, which is a great position to be in, because as a restaurateur, it's not, time is not something that you've ever got. It's, you open in a month, it's all a new team, it's all very rushed. But hopefully this way, it's, we can sort of take our time between now and then and get it right before we open.
Yeah. And how are you finding that? Because you're training people who have gone from pie and mash to fine dining. So do they already have some of the skill set already?
So pie and mash, although we are producing the pies from James Street, I have a chef that does that. That's his full-time job. So that's not actually the chefs we'll be taking to Pivot. The chefs I'll be taking to Pivot are the chefs that have been here for the last 6 or 7 months, but all got amazing pedigrees. My sous chef comes from Helen de Rosa, which is 3 stars. My chef de party comes from a 1 star. My other chef de party comes from a 1 star. Amazing. At the moment, that's not the style of food we're cooking in James Street. It's a lot more casual.
Yeah.
But I have done a series of dinners. We are doing a lot of behind the scenes development with these chefs. My pie and mash chef is a completely separate chef who isn't coming to Pivot. So
right. If you need anyone to come and sample your dishes, I'm available. Let me know.
I'm sure you'll be on the list. Don't worry. I'm sure you'll be on the list.
Right. So teaching and mentoring and charity work as well play a big role in your life. Talk to us about why that means so much to you.
I mean, I think it means so much to a lot of chefs of a certain age. I think it means a lot to a lot of chefs of a certain age, because you start to realise that you do need to give back to the industry. So every year I'll do a dinner at L20 Hotel School in Liverpool, where I'll take one of my chefs, we'll go along, we'll cook with the students. You know, I don't get paid for it. I would never want to be paid for it, because all I'm doing is giving my time. And my time to me is free. Mm. It might not be to some people, but to me it's free. So if you can pass on knowledge and sort of try and inspire someone, for me that's one of the greatest feelings that you could never pay me for. And it's the same with charity work. I mean, you know, every year I used to change the charity that I gave my time to. Because again, I'm only giving time. It doesn't cost me anything to do that. And if I can help raise awareness, raise money for a charity, why not? It doesn't cost me anything. And if I'm helping someone, then fantastic. I think it's just something that, you know, mentoring the younger generation or mentoring charity workers or raising money for charity, or I think it's something that we should all do a little more of, and I probably don't do enough of, although I do probably more than most or more than some. It's just something that I feel quite passionate about. Yeah.
And so going back to your staff, obviously, you put them through training. It's like mentorship as well. How do you get the fine line between discipline and dictatorship?
I mean, it's a very fine line, I think, because you know what staff, hopefully what staff realize is, yes, of course, as the business owner or as the head chef, you know, my staff don't work for me, they work with me. And that's, I never want to be seen as the dictator. It's his way, it's the only way. But the fine line becomes so fine when we've agreed on something. In my mind, that's the way it works. It then doesn't deviate at all. Because I think if you allow 10 staff to do everything their own way, you've got one thing getting done 10 different ways. There's no consistency, there's no standard, there's no quality. So I think as long as the staff understand that once something's made or agreed upon, and that could be the way that we seat a guest, it could be the way we hand over menus, it could be the way we make a carrot puree. I mean, it goes with everything. As soon as we've set the standard, and I say we, because I mean me and my team, that's the standard that then everyone follows. And I think it is a very fine line because, you know, chefs want to be creative, they want their ideas to be listened to, and they 100% are, and so are restaurant managers and so are sommeliers. But the line becomes the line when they are listened to, we've made a decision, and that's the answer. And it could be their way. But that's the way we all have to then do it. And it is a very fine line, but I always feel that, you know, my staff work with me, not for me. I am a member of staff during service. You know, I don't stand there, smoke cigars, and drink coffee. You know, I am on the line, and I will be for as long as I can be. And it's just building that, you know, relationship with, I mean, my head chef in Edinburgh, Duncan, has been with me all over the world. You know, Singapore, London, Boston, Tokyo, Liverpool once a year. And he's been with me 7 years. Started as junior sous chef, then sous chef, now he's my head chef. And, you know, building that relationship with the staff doesn't, you know, that's a relationship that we've built on over 7 years. And it makes it incredibly easy to write menus because I can say to Duncan, right, so let's do the monkfish, but do you remember the sauce that we used to do with, and then the way we've done the artichokes with? And he's like, yep, scribble. I mean, it's incredibly easy to write menus with him because he knows my food so well, and I'm not going to change the way I make carrot puree this week than I did a year ago. So it's great to have that trust in someone else, and it means I can then go off and do other things and allow Duncan to, you know, treat that team as his team. So yeah, it's all about making the staff feel like they're part of the team as well, which hopefully.
Speaking of doing other things, so I have your cookbook, which
Oh,
is
that old thing.
absolutely fabulous.
Thank you.
Really hard to find. I know it's sold out everywhere.
Yeah.
But this is actually one of your key moments, which you're super proud of, which, I mean, the book went on to win best cookbook in the world in the chef's category, which is pretty amazing. Talk to us about the process and the journey that you've been on with the book.
I mean, I think I initially wanted to write a book because I thought I had a story to tell that might interest someone. And it ended up that it interested quite a lot of people, which is great. But I mean, I would love to do another one. I would like for the next one to be slightly easier. It was a long, hard process. It's not as easy as people think it is to write a book. I certainly didn't write it to win awards. That's not why you write books. I wrote it because I thought I had a story to tell. And I'm just so thankful that it was so well received. And I think one of the reasons it was probably so well received is because the photography within the book is so amazing.
It's
I mean,
beautiful.
the food's obviously my food. And if I didn't like my food, I would change it. So I obviously like the food. But I just think the photography is just absolutely stunning. And it's, I think really set it apart from a lot of books that, that I had seen. And I called the book Perceptions because although I've been incredibly lucky over the last 10 years to travel for work all over the world, I'd done a talk in Thailand about 8 or 9 years ago about the perception of British food abroad. And it was to journalists from all over the world. And there was 5 sessions. So I'd done the same talk 5 times. But it was fine. I knew what I was going to say. And I had a slideshow set up. And my first question was, what is the perception of British food abroad? And it had to be British because it was through Visit Britain. So it couldn't just be me talking about Scotland. And the perception was that we all eat steak pie, fish and chips, deep fried Mars bar, haggis, shepherd's pie, greasy stodge. But then as soon as I said, well, wait a minute, Marco, Gordon, Heston, they were all like, oh, well, yeah, they are British. So I called it perceptions because I wanted to, in my little way, from my small restaurant, change the perception of Scottish food any way I could. And if you had looked at Scottish cookbooks 5 years ago, you know, for the last 40 years, Scottish cookbooks almost look like the tin of shortbread. They've got a bit of tartan on it, and they've got, and you look even now, if you go on Amazon, with the exclude, you know, with the exception, you know, Martin Wishart brought a book out, Tom Kitchen's now brought several books out. Before that, there was no real Scottish, modern Scottish cookbooks that that made or gave particular attention to suppliers. There just wasn't. It was all books full of Scotch broth and stews. Whereas I think my book, Perceptions, is a Scottish cookbook because the ingredients are Scottish. I'm Scottish. It was written in Scotland. The photographer's Scottish. It is a Scottish cookbook. So that's why it was called Perceptions. And then to go on win the award it did was just a great excuse for me to go to China. which was great because China's not a country at the time I had a chance to go and work in. A lot of the last 10 years, my holidays have been work. So if I go to Singapore to do a dinner for a week or Tokyo or Boston or Istanbul or wherever I go, that's, I treat them as holidays. They're not, it's not just work. So I hadn't had the chance to go to China until then. So it was a great excuse to go.
Yeah. And how did you find it?
Amazing. The people were so amazing. We went to a small city called Yantai, which has a small population of 6 million. So it's not small at all, but it is in terms of China. We flew into Shanghai. We spent 2 days in Shanghai. Went and spent a week doing the cookbook awards. Flew back to Shanghai, done 2 more days. Flew home. So we sort of, you know, we pulled about 2 weeks out of an awards dinner. So it was quite well done. It was quite well done. So yeah, it was just, you know, they're just such amazing experiences because to work and travel, again, going back to the opening conversation, 25 years ago, this was not a thing. It's not something that even ever crossed my mind that would be possible. So I'm sort of still living that fairy tale of, I can't believe people pay me to do this.
Yeah.
So it's a long way from washing dishes and my tall chef's hat and my neckerchief, but I'm not going to complain.
Well, in your book, you talk about your fiance being a huge part of your life. Did you end up walking her down the aisle in between your shifts?
We're still engaged. Still engaged. And I wrote the book 3 or 4 years ago. So she's a very patient woman.
Yeah. Tell me something about yourself that I couldn't possibly know.
What can I tell you? Apart from my total addiction to YouTube, would that be something that nobody would know? I'm totally addicted to YouTube. That's my downtime is 100% spent watching YouTube.
What do you watch?
Everything from Fortnite gaming videos to cat videos to
music.
I don't have Spotify. I just watch YouTube.
Okay.
I honestly don't think there's anything that you would want to watch that isn't on YouTube.
My videos are on YouTube.
I've watched them, I know. So yeah, I'm just, it's not the first thing I do in the morning when I wake up, but it's probably the second thing I do. The first thing I do is open my emails at 6 a.m. every morning. And the second thing I do is I go onto YouTube to see what's happening. I watch the news on it. I don't think I've watched live television for about 2 years. I just don't think there's a need to watch live television anymore. Anything you want is on YouTube. It's great.
I've never thought of YouTube that way as like, you know, kind of like my TV channel.
That's what I use. I also have Netflix, which is how I binge TV series.
Right.
But yeah, I'm totally addicted to YouTube. I hate it.
Well, I'm surprised you have the time. You've got so much going on.
I think it's because I don't have the time. I enjoy it so much because it's just instant.
Yeah.
Instant, you know, whatever you want to watch is instantly there.
Yeah. And probably from your journey to and fro from Scotland, right? You probably.
I normally go train. And there's amazing Wi-Fi, which means I can do all my emails. For the last sort of year, that's how I've been traveling. So yeah, that's probably office time for me rather than YouTube is before I go to bed and after I've woken up in the morning.
Right. Okay. There's something that I wanted to ask you about earlier, and I wasn't sure if you're comfortable talking about this actually. So we touched on it, your near-death experience. If I may ask, is it, you know, how we hear about, you know, it's sort of like a white light?
Absolutely nothing.
Nothing like that.
Nothing at all. So I can't even remember. No, can't remember at all.
So you just blacked out. It was a black light.
I just went to sleep. I don't think I dreamt of anything. I just, nothing at all, unfortunately.
Well, it's been, we're glad that you made it back from that experience. And, you know, you just kind of, it sounds like you're such a get up and go character. You just kind of get on with things, don't you?
Yeah, I think you have to. I think, you know, throughout your whole career as a chef, you always want that promotion. You always, you know, because it is quite, you know, you start as a commis, then you want to be demi chef to party, junior sous chef, head chef. And I think once you get to head chef you become an owner, is what's next. You know, for the last 25 years, I've trained myself to want what's next. And as a chef, you have to, otherwise you would be a commis forever.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to do that. So once you do become the business owner, it's how do I make the business better? How do I make the staff's life better? How do I grow the business to make all that a little bit easier?
Yeah.
I think it's just natural as a chef to do that.
Yeah, it's a great mindset to have. And I think you're right. It is a very natural, if you've got it in you, then it is a very, very natural path. And we look forward to seeing Mark Greenaway's establishments all over London. Sounds like you're going to be making waves here. Hopefully. And I can't wait for the new opening. It's very exciting. A pivot. Can't wait.
I'll make sure you get an invite.
I look forward to it. Thank you so much for your time, Mark. It's been a pleasure chatting with you and getting to know you better.
No worries. Thank you very much for having me.
And you guys, if you want to follow with what Mark is up to, you can find him on Instagram at Chef Mark Greenaway, and I'm at Posh Nosh Girl. And if you enjoyed today's interview, please subscribe, rate, and review. It helps others find me.